Good afternoon and welcome to all of you. For the sake of the recording, I'm to tell you that you're here at Buchanan's. What a surprise. For the 12:30 to 2 o'clock panel, creativity feels so good and hurts so bad. Before I introduce our first sufferer, I just coincidentally came across a little piece, and I feel I can take the liberty to read this. It's just a short paragraph. David Watts, one of our panelists, is ill and not going to be here, so we have a tiny bit of extra space, but I thought this was so appropriate. Paul Durell, in his book Living the Artist's Life, said this: "All right, so we all suffer, but by God, we know how to live too. And by we, I don't mean just artists, but anyone who lives sensually and through the power of their creativity, whether in the art world or the corporate world. Few people are given the gift to live in this way. Few people are able to feel so fully alive between the spells of suffering. That suffering is merely the price you pay for your talent." So, I'm going to introduce our panelists one at a time. And our first sufferer. Oh. Good. Okay. Our first sufferer is Kate Lehrer. And here's how rumors get started. A quick read of the first paragraph of her bio told me Kate was a bigamist who came out in 2004. But you've all read the bios, so I know that you know that's not true. If you're a reader, pick up Confessions of a Bigamist or Out of Eden, Kate's book that won the Western Heritage Award, or simply tune in to NPR's where you'll hear her on the Diane Rehm Show Book Club. Welcome to one of our most literary guests of this conference, Kate Lehrer.
Thank you, Marcia, and now I'm going to let everybody down. I was going to start talking about, can everybody hear back there? Okay, can you hear? Okay. I was going to start by telling you all the good stuff, but right now I think I'll start with, you know, why it hurts so bad. I have just started, Confessions of a Bigamist came out in last June, and I've just now started in January a new book. I spent the whole fall and most of the summer twiddling my thumbs. And the fact of the matter is, I didn't want to go through all over again the anxiety of not knowing where I was going with my book, which is how I write. And I'll talk more about that in a few minutes. But this, for me, can be very painful, a whole first draft, because I don't know where I'm going, and I don't know if it's going to be any good. I don't even know if I'm saying anything. I don't know, like a book about a woman bigamist, is that just a one-note, you know, stand, or is that the only way it will be taken? I have no idea what I'm doing as I'm doing it. And somehow or other, this time around, it just seemed like it was too much to have to go through all over again. But I'll also tell you the good part. Even once I finally settled down and thought, buck up, pull up your socks, get going again, the good thing about that, and I'll talk as a fiction writer, but I do think this applies to anybody who is involved and engaged in any endeavor whatsoever, including life itself. So that's really what I'm talking about. But I've always found that for me, it really is, once I let go, it's an escape, you know, into an imaginative space, something I've created for myself, and I'm lost in it. I'm lost in it for as long as I, you know, can be. And while I'm there, I
actually, you know, there's I have a picture of a mental picture of creating sort of a sense of intimacy with myself in a way I never do otherwise, and it's as if I'm whispering to myself the secrets of what might come out, secrets I don't yet know, and they come out, and it feels like a miracle when they do come out, if they do come out. And when you finally feel like, yes, I've got something here, I've gone from just stringing words together, stringing facts together, just even stringing a bunch of thoughts together and created a sensation or an effect, suddenly it's like, yes, I got it. I got it. And it is like create, because you, what you want your readers to get, what you want for yourself, is something that feels almost physical when you get it. It's tangible almost, that sensation in effect. Now, that said, that yes comes, and that can make me happy for, oh, 1 or 2 days until I go back into the, oh, God, what am I going to do now? Because as soon as you get that, oh, yes, and you think you've got that sensation, then try for yourself explaining whatever it is you do and love, your passion. You find you've got something that seems like you've grasped something, like a revelatory moment. And then you think, but what does that mean? And how do you describe that? And it takes you back into the thing, because anything halfway good, you've got to keep questioning yourself. You've got to keep probing where it's going. You've got to keep stirring up your plot. And you have to make yourself uncomfortable, you know, all the time, all over again as you're writing. And my theory is that if you come up with just too many pat answers, then you haven't done a very good job, because there ought to be questions, and there ought to always be questions, because there's always someplace else you can take that stuff. And this is uncomfortable, and it's sometimes not fun. Which brings me back to the idea of anxiety and also frustration. What I hate most is when I'm letting it go. When I'm, you know, finally in January, I said, okay, I got to start writing. I've just got to. Well, for a change, I thought, at least know a little bit. And I had, so I'd write a little sketch of chapter one. And then chapter two, I thought, oh, that's going to be this. And so I put 3 sentences down. Fine. Got to chapter three, little bit of a sketch. So I sketched myself away through about 5 chapters, and suddenly I think, I can't go any, I'm just blocked, I can't go any further. Well, 5 chapters sort of sketched out is, for me, amazing. It's not that I don't have some sense of what I want to talk about or something that's going to happen, but I have no idea where it's really taking me to get there. So I got that far, and I think this is a good way to describe, I mean, my process about what happens, I think, with lots of artists and people who are thinking in terms of ideas, is that I got that far, and I thought, I've really got to flesh the whole scene out, because I couldn't go anywhere until I fleshed the whole scene out, wrote the scene. Soon as I wrote the scene, I had new characters, I had a whole new, I've now got a family. I had never planned to bring a dysfunctional family into this new book, ever. I mean, this was really not where I was going. And so here I am, suddenly with all this stuff going on. Since that time, I've had to write, you know, I am now writing the book, essentially. It's going to be only a first draft, but I can only go as far as my writing goes. What can happen? And for some reason, this is really, really stopping me this time, or it's not stopping me, but it's making me agonize a lot more than I wish I were, is that I'm not willing to lose control and just turn it all over to essentially almost unconscious processes. I want to keep the control. It's I don't know. I just want to. So that I think what anybody who's really going deep has to do is you have to let go of that control. It's almost a Zen state, and you have to trust that there really is something in there and that you really do know how to bring it out, and it probably is going to come out. It won't be a finished product. I mean, I rewrite a million times, but there's something there to go to. And it's that matter of letting go and trusting yourself. And for me, at any rate, that's an incredibly difficult thing to do. in some ways, and Paul may disagree, I don't know, and all you men in this room may disagree, but I think it's much harder for women a lot of times to do that than men. I don't know, but that's been my experience at any rate. The other part of it is as I said earlier, is it going to be good enough? Have I really said anything at all? Where is it? What's going on? That goes on until, you know, my editor has just come and literally taken the book away from me, frankly. With my last book, she finally took the manuscript and she would go over things on the phone. And she would make the changes. I mean, we're talking like little, because I start, you know, I rewrite. She says, make this sentence a little clearer. Well, I rewrite the whole damn chapter. I mean, you know, it's just nuts. And so she had it all. She had it. And I couldn't touch it. It was just a matter of our talking on the phone. She's in New York. I'm in Washington. The other part is that, as I say, is that frustration, because however deep you go, you can go another level and you can keep going deeper. And what you're always, I think, trying to do is look for the underlying reality. And realities, you know, overlap and they contradict each other. I think there are a lot of them. Reality goes on all kinds of different planes. We can be talking on one, that's one reality right now, what each of you are getting, all the other thoughts that are going on in your mind. There's just so many things that go on all the time, so that it's how far you can go. And the frustration is, of course, you can never capture all that. You can never capture even a part of it, really. But the important thing, I guess, you know your desires and you have a sense of your limitations, but you hate it. You just hate it that you can't go any farther. And yet, I think for probably everybody here, all you can do is just keep on trucking. I mean, just keep on riding, keep on, you know, biting your nails and hoping something comes out, hoping you can stay zen-like enough.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Sally Faye is a bundle of energy from New York. She seems to be dancing and singing and writing and producing and receiving awards through her life, tempered by a divorce support group that she facilitates and her volunteer work at a women's maximum security prison. Keep your eyes on the New York Times for the Sally and Company's new musical, Move It and It's Yours.
We're thinking investors also.
And I hope that sooner or later Sally will share with us how she gets people to do the things that she wants them to do. They're really weird things and people do them. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's just because of who she is. Please welcome Sally Faye.
Oh, gosh.
Thank you for the lovely introduction. I'm just curious, how many people here are performers? Okay, and how many people are writers? You know, a lot of writers. And how many people maybe visual artists? Okay, so we really have a nice mix of all kinds. And I know I haven't plumbed all the ways that creativity manifests itself, but I was just curious as to what kind, you know, we had a nice mix in here. When I first saw this topic, I was said to a few of my fellow conference attendees, I said, I'm having trouble figuring out what hurts about this. And you know, I said, so help me access, you know, I'm sure I'm hurting somewhere. So help me access where my hurt is. And sure enough, they did. So this can be a nice experience, therapy experience for us conference attendees as well. But I, you know, that said, I'm thinking, okay, the reason that it was hard for me to access, you know, what hurts about creativity is that I have been very lucky in my life, and not all creative people are. I've always been supported by the people around me in my creativity, starting with my family. My father My father's father, my paternal grandfather, who I never met, was a fairly famous illustrator artist. My father was a commercial photographer by trade. My mother had her own radio show post college in Houston. She was an actress, on the radio, and had done plays and had been a ballet dancer. So when my creativity started to bloom, and when I was little, all I wanted to be when I grew up was discovered. I still haven't really been discovered, but thank you for that lovely introduction. That's another reason we come here. It makes me feel like I have been discovered to some degree. But that was always what I said. When people said, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" Discovered. So I've always been. I was a ham when I was a little girl. I was in every play. I would do the little shows in the living room, for my parents and my older sister, who I love dearly, but she's gone, it's a different path. So I was the little creative one, funny, always liked to make people laugh, still do. I really enjoy that. But I had that kind of family support, so that when I finished high school, went to college, and began a major in theater, I was supported in that. I didn't have any family members telling me, get a second major just in case, I went to school in the Midwest, University of Wisconsin, then University of Minnesota. I majored in theater. I stayed in the Minneapolis area, where they have lots of theater going on. Got a lot of good experience, but then it was sort of, shit or get off the pot time. I was either going to go to California or New York. So I came back to New York, where I was from, because that's where my support network was. So this has been, I did the usual thing of being in New York, trying to find my way as an actress, as an entertainer. And then the second thing that I was lucky about happened, and that was I met two men. David Finkel is one of the another conference attendee, and Bill Whedon, and they are, to this day, they're my writing partners, and we performed together for almost over 20 years. And I think that one of the reasons the creativity process, because I think it's this dual thing, it's creativity and the process, which you beautifully described in your creative process. There's two things we're talking about, at least in my view. Being a creative person, and then the creative process. So when I think another reason I have blunted the hurt has been I've always been a collaborator for the most part. I have, for much of my creative life, I had two people, and there were three of us, and we understood each other so beautifully that, and we could bounce things off each other, and so we didn't suffer, that lonely feeling, which as a writer, which I now do a lot of writing on my own, the blank page syndrome. My God, the nails. She says she doesn't bite her nails anymore. The minute I start a project, they're down, they're bleeding, because it's I can't keep that hand from going, to my mouth. But for the most part, the creative process for me has been a collaborative one. The third reason that I have, not been hurt that much is because I'm older now and I've accepted who I am. When I was younger and creative, it was a real double-edged sword. I liked feeling different. I knew I was different, and I was unique. But in those peer pressure days of high school, I actually dropped the drama club when I was in high school because only geeks and weirdos were in the drama club, and I opted for the popular crowd, so I knew I couldn't be in the drama club. I felt that pressure not to really follow my creativity when I was in high school. I remember, that adolescent feeling of feeling different and not quite knowing why. It was lonely, it's been a lonely feeling for me off and on. Which I think is why creative people tend to stick together, because they understand each other even as they get older. But as I'm older now, I can accept who I am, and it's kind of funny. You mentioned that reading you mentioned you read was wonderful because it mentioned the corporate world, which I also deal in. And there's nothing more fun than being the creative person in a corporate setting. Because, you know, as long as you have a sense of your parameters, which after 20 years of writing corporate entertainment, believe me, I do, I respect those boundaries and don't push people past their limits, but it's kind of fun because people are sort of entertained by you, a little bit awed by you, and you sort of get a lot of latitude in that setting, and it's fun, and I don't take advantage of it, you know, unfairly. So the hurt for me was the loneliness of feeling creative and not feeling part of the human race at different times in my life, especially when I was younger, but still when I came back to New York and was trying to find my way and make a little money. And my peers had jumped into great jobs and they were all making plenty of money. And when we got together for going out to a bar or going out for lunch, they'd always pick up the check and say, "Oh, Sally, you're going to make it someday and you'll be taking all of us out." And it's like, I haven't even done that yet, you know. But, you know, I can look back and think, oh, that was, yeah. But that hurt at the time, and I thought, you know, have I made the right choice? But luckily, you know, my support always told me that I had made the right choice for myself, and it felt so good. Just a funny thing that hurt me, my sister, who I mentioned before, who I love dearly, and we're just closer now than we ever were, but she hurt me, and she'll never know why. When I was trying to make money in New York, I was on quiz shows. Anybody ever been on a quiz show? I'm sure many. People lived in New York back in the late 70s and the 80s, it was not uncommon for people in show business to try to become contestants on the quiz shows that were filmed in New York. And you couldn't say you were an actress or an entertainer. You had to lie and say you were a nutritionist, and that's what I was. Sally Faye, our nutritionist. So I had been on a little quiz show called Shoot for the Stars, which didn't last very long, but I was partnered with LeVar Burton and Anita Gillette, and I won $5,000. And I thought, well, this is nice. You know, I don't have to work as a waitress or, you know, and so I was actually cleaning apartments. That's what I did for my day job. But so I thought, well, bigger fish to fry. So I auditioned for the $10,000 pyramid, which was the daytime version of the $25,000 pyramid, and the $10,000 was the top prize. And my partner was Penny Marshall. And I won. We won together. And, you know, they shoot all these shows in one day. You know, they have their pool of contestants sitting in the studio audience, and you just keep going up, and they shoot all five shows for the week in one day. So my sister and my father were in the audience just in case I got chosen as a contestant, so they would be there. Well, I did get chosen. We won. And I will never forget my sister climbing over seats, you know, because people really do get excited. That is, to this day, the most exciting thing I have ever done in show business, as far as she's concerned. That hurt so bad. I have performed hundreds of shows. I have written shows. I have, you know, that's still the most, you know, that's it. I plumbed the depths and came up with that. So now I'm cleansed of that. But, you know, as far as the creative process, you know, I thought Kate's talking about it was wonderful. Because a lot of the things she mentioned, I feel too. You know, when I sit down with a blank page, I do a lot of the marketing writing now, which I do on my own. And Bill and David and I still work together, but in the interest of time, we take sections. And, you know, you write this song, you write this scene, you write. And so we are doing work by ourselves, not sitting in a room, you know, arguing over every word and every line. There comes that time where you sit down, and for me, it's, you know, I have to do everything else first, because there's such a repelling, you know, idea of actually having to sit down and fill that screen with something, that the nails go. I find, oh, there's a crumb over there on the floor. Let me go pick that up. I better go. You know, I will do everything not to start. So thank God for deadlines, because I have learned how to write, how to be creative on a deadline, and you know, I thank God for it, because I can't imagine the things I'd come up with to procrastinate if I didn't have deadlines. The other thing I'm grateful for in my creative process is measurement. You know, I have a sense of measurement. When we were doing the corporate shows, our songs had to really hit the audiences where they live. They had to really have insights into what they went through in their work every day and where their company was at and where their industry was at. And we had a sense of hitting the mark and how to hit the mark, and it was measured. We always knew that we were on track. That was a good feeling. When you write and it just goes into the void and you have all these variables and you have to pick, that is such a scary feeling. You know, because there is no, there's really no measurement. You're just measuring yourself. So, that said, I have no other choice. I couldn't do anything else. Thank you. And there is really no better feeling for me as a performer for people to applaud. If you've been, you are performers, you know what that feeling is like, to have the feeling while you're performing that the audience is with you, which is something you can tangibly feel. You can also tangibly feel when they're not. But when you feel that they are, there is just, it's just a wonderful feeling. It's very difficult to describe. As a writer of plays in particular, sitting at the back of the audience and hearing people laugh, even cry at something you have written on a page and it's now being acted, it's just one of the best feelings I've ever had in my life. So, you know, it's all worth it. Thank you.